Welcome to Venturi's Voice. I'm Andy Davis. Venturi's Voice brings together thought leaders from a variety of industries who are taking the most innovative approaches to leadership and staffing. Imagine having a mix of experienced mentors sharing their secrets on leadership, recruiting, onboarding, engagement, and motivating, as well as stories on life lessons they've learned along the way. And it's free. If you're the head of a major corporation leading a team of hundreds or about to take on your first leadership role, this podcast is for you. The show is about you, and we're here to help you become the best leader you can be. Stay up to date with the latest shows by subscribing on iTunes and SoundCloud, as well as signing up to the newsletter at venturi-group.com, where you can find the latest IT jobs, talent, and blogs on all things leadership, staffing, and development. I'd love to hear from you, so drop me a line anytime via email at andy.davis@venturi-group.com. Any feedback or requests are always welcome. Enjoy the show.
Today's guest is Jeremy Keith. Jeremy is the technical lead and co-founder of the design agency Clear Left in Brighton. Jeremy's been writing on his personal site, adactio.com, for over 15 years. He's also written a number of books, DOM Scripting, Bulletproof IAX, HTML5 for Web Designers, and most recently, Resilient Web Design, which you can read for free online. He also maintains thesession.org, an online community dedicated to Irish traditional music, and he created huffduffer.com, a site for creating your podcast of found sounds. When he's not making websites, he's playing the bouzouki in the band Salter Kane. There's something that's quite interesting at the moment, and I think it's been going on for a while, and I think the movement has really come from the technical community, but it's very much this open source, if you want to call it that, and open community about just the sharing of information and findings. I had a gentleman on the podcast a few days ago, actually, and I found this difficult to understand, but he would put stuff on GitHub and things like this, and just put the projects that he built out on open source, and someone offered him quite a substantial amount of money for one of the projects that he'd actually built, and he wouldn't give it up because he felt that it would kind of go unseen, and this company would take it over, and the rest of the technical world would never be able to take advantage of. So he decided not to sell. He did say he regretted it, actually, like years later, but I suppose when you've got to pay the mortgage. But it's a really interesting example of the kind of the sharing community that we're in at the moment. And, you've written books, you're really active online, on social, about getting your kind of messages out there. And as I said, my feelings are that kind of willingness to share our findings, I think it has been a kind of a grassroots movement from the technical community. But what's your take on it? And, why do you think you've been compelled to share what you have, and why the technical community in general is so motivated by being open and sharing their findings?
That's a great question. Wasn't that way for as long as I can remember, certainly on the web. I'd have to narrow it down, and I can only really speak about the web as opposed to the technical community in general, because obviously there's people doing things on computers in general. There is a long history of open source and free software and all of that, but I don't really know those worlds, like, let's say, gaming development or desktop software. I only know about the web, and certainly on the web, right from the start, it was all about the sharing. I remember when I first got on the web and I was showing some sites to a friend of mine. They were like music fan sites. Somebody's just made a fan site about some band we both like. And my friend was asking, but why would they do this? Why would they, go to the effort and the trouble of making this thing, and it's up there for free, and they're not asking for any money or anything? And to me, I it seemed kind of normal. But I think certainly on the web, it's to a certain extent built into the nature of it when you think about where it came from. That the web started at CERN. That's where Tim Berners-Lee came up with it. And CERN is not motivated by a lot of the same motivations that a typical organization would be motivated by, like like profit or, you know, return on investment. It's entirely about pure scientific research. And I feel like maybe that somehow got baked into the DNA of the web. And to a certain extent, the internet before it, you know, when they were working on the ARPANET, which led to the internet, it was, you know, educational institutions and, again, sort of non-traditional business structures, let's say, not, you know, shareholder value motivated places. So maybe to a certain extent, the technology kind of lends itself to sharing more easily. I certainly remember, you know, in the early days, if you wanted to sell something, that was certainly a lot harder than simply throwing it up there for free. And it's always felt like maybe there's maybe more value with some things in the reputational gain than there is in the financial gain. Like how much money you will make directly from selling something to a small amount of people would turn out to be less than if you give things away to a large amount of people and through that some opportunity comes up or later on down the line you end up making money in other means, but because you established that reputation through giving it away. Now, when I put it like that, it makes it sound like the reason to do it is to establish the reputation and it'll all pay itself back. And I think that's not a good reason to do it. I kind of feel like it's, in a weird way, you should do it for a very selfish, self-motivated reason, which is it's just, you know, it feels good to share and put stuff out there. And then it's always a nice surprise if something good comes of it. If someone, even if it's not financial, if it's just more like someone says, oh, that thing you shared really helped me. It was really useful to me. That's a good feeling. So that's kind of a selfish reason to do it in a way. But throughout my time on the web, it's occurred over and over. And when I was starting, you know, I wanted to learn how to make web pages. I wanted to learn HTML and stuff like that. And there were all these resources available because people had freely shared what they knew. And so when then I knew something worth sharing, it just seemed natural that I would put it out there and share it. So there's a bit of a positive feedback loop as well that, you know, because you've learned through other people sharing, you kind of feel like you need to pass it on to a certain extent. And these days it's easier than ever to share online because we have things like GitHub for code and you know, CodePen and Dribbble for design screenshots and stuff. So that the systems are in place now to even more easily share and collaborate and put things out there. But it feels like it's always been that way on the web, and it feels like it suits the web, this kind of sharing.
It's a really interesting one, and the way, you know, you kind of started to dive into it, there is a sense that there's clear consciousness about, you know, we can scale if we give things away for free. And, you know, maybe there's a bigger opportunity to be had, whether it be fiscally or whatever whatever the incentive is later down the road. But I don't necessarily think that was the way that things started. I tend to think that it really just stems from wanting to get your message out there and from a place of passion. And I do think that now people have, I suppose, taken advantage of it in a lot of ways. And now they want to, you know, scale their product up for, you know, the purpose of actually selling and promoting something, which is absolutely fine. I just think that we're in a place now where, as you said, it's easy to share, make content and share it, that the water has been a little bit muddied and maybe the quality has reduced a little bit. That's certainly my feeling, but that's just, I suppose, a little bit of a skeptic's perspective on things.
Yeah, I mean, I tend not to worry about quality because I feel like, you know, good stuff will surface. I think it could be worse when people think, right, I'm going to wait until this thing is perfect. You know, this thing I want to share, maybe it's an article, maybe it's a piece of code, maybe it's a design. And I'm going to make sure it's really good and then I'll share it. And quite often you never get around to sharing it. It never gets out there because it's not perfect and you want to finesse it. And then it ends up sitting in a drawer somewhere. Whereas I think if you just have a quick idea, you just, you know what, I'll just write a brain fart of a blog post, or I'll just like throw this idea out there. And it might not be very good, but maybe one in five of them somebody picks up and goes, oh, that's actually a really interesting thing, and that prompts me to write about something else. And so I'm generally in favor of quality, but I think there's something to be said about quantity, because the pursuit of quality when it comes to sharing things can be almost like a self-censorship. Like, I'm going to have to wait until it's perfect until I share it, and then you never end up sharing it. And there's something to be said with just publishing your drafts, right? You know, this thing's been sitting in my draft folder for too long. I'm just going to publish it, even though it's not perfect, even though it's not ready. I'm just going to get it out there and then see what happens. Let people filter, I guess.
Right. Yeah, well, I think that's a really good point, and something that commercially, you know, I've obviously been involved in a number of tech companies, and, you know, when you think about kind of the product team and that, you know, thirst for feedback, you know, it's kind of along those same lines.
Yeah, get it out there as quickly as possible, so that then, obviously it's got problems, but you won't find out what the problems really are until you get something out there really quick. I understand, though, when people are reticent, though, because, you know, the whole thing about you never get a second chance to make a first impression. So people, if they're thinking in terms of the big launch, right, on this day we're going to launch the product, then it is kind of like a pre-digital mindset of, like, it's got to be good. You know, the printing press, printing your book, and once it's out there, it's set. It's really got to be perfect. And again, that can lead to self-censorship, and the thing never actually ships because you want it to be perfect. Whereas because we're on the web and we're working in digital, you can ship something knowing full well it's not perfect, that it needs work, but you can then change it. I mean, that's the great thing about the web, is that if you're shipping a product on the web and there's an issue, you fix the issue and you ship the update, and shipping the update is instantaneous, and literally all your customers now get the updated version of your product without them having to do anything new. And I feel like sometimes we don't take advantage of that on the web. I know I find we do it ourselves at work. We'd be like, oh, I was going to post this blog post, but could you, you know, check it out one more time, make sure it's just right. And I'm like, post it anyway, and I'll check it out after you've published it. Or if there's any typos, somebody will find them. You know, it's really easy to change things on the web. And sometimes we still think as though it's the launch day mentality, that first impression really matters. And maybe the first impression does really matter. I understand that. But taking advantage of the iterative cycle on the web to constantly be changing and tweaking and improving things because you're getting that feedback all the time, that's a huge advantage to working on the web.
Yeah, and it's so and it aligns so well commercially as well. I mean you must know from you know, from your business, I'm sure it's constant. You know, you're constantly seeking for feedback, looking out for comparable companies where you might be able to, you know, see what other people are doing. How can we improve? Like, the pursuit of perfection never really ends. And now, as you said, with the web, we can kind of approach things, you know, without kind of using the coin term, but in more of an agile way. I think we are still kind of stuck in that, you know, big launch mentality.
Yeah. And like you said, that pursuit of perfection can be like, it can get you down because you think, oh, it's never perfect. But once you accept that it's never perfect, but you can always keep improving it, then you can kind of switch your own mindset and think like, oh, it's never perfect in a good way. It'll never be perfect. That's okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. It's true. And, you know, I think if you're getting feedback, brilliant. I think you should start worrying when you're not getting feedback, positive or negative. Not that I'm a big Justin Bieber fan, but I think the most played YouTube video in the world, I think, was his. And it also had the most dislike, you know, like on YouTube, you can dislike or like it, I think. It also had the most dislikes on the web as well. But, you know, I think that's just a really good acronym for encouraging people just to get it out there. You know, not everyone's going to like it. Some people will like it. You just have to kind of find, you know, a happy medium and kind of accept that. And, you know, I think the web's kind of unforgiving in that way, but at the same time, you know, a fantastic place to learn, you know, if you just kind of put stuff out there. And, you know, with your kind of background as well, I'm sure you had those anxieties when you were putting out, you know, maybe your first book or your first company. And, you know, I'd actually be curious to see, like, how you overcame that fear and just kind of went for it.
Well, it's interesting because I talk to other people who are, and let's talk at a small scale. Let's talk about just like having your own website where you're going to publish things, right? A blog or something. And I've been doing that for a long time. And I guess maybe because when I started, I knew there was nobody reading it. That was quite liberating, right? Knowing that nobody's going to be sitting there in judgment allows you to do whatever you want. But I talk to people, like I said, I'm encouraging them to start a blog or start writing on the web. And I'm like, yeah, but, you know, either they'll say no one will read it, and that's a reason not to publish, or they're saying, but people will read it, and that's a reason not to publish, right? People are going to read it and find fault with it, or they'll say, who are you to write this, or that's been said already, or why are you even writing this? Of course, all these things are actually coming from within, right? That's the inner critic, this voice in your head telling you the reasons not to do something. So when I'm writing on my site, even to this day, you know, 15 years later, I'm still not writing for an audience. I'm not thinking about people out there reading this. I kind of write for myself, or I do have like this figure of the reader in my head, and the reader is effectively me. But it's me. I just haven't heard about this thing yet, right? So I want to share this cool thing I found. And imagine someone just like me out there, except they haven't heard about this new thing. So that's who I'm writing for. To be honest, a lot of the time I am writing literally for myself, in that it's almost like a note to self, right? Save this for later. You might want to come and revisit this further down the line. And so because I'm not thinking about the audience, that's very, very liberating, right? I write whatever I want to my site. I can do what I want. Now, obviously, that's very different if you're building a product for users, because you don't want to be building it for you and you don't want to just be thinking about what you want. That's a good starting point, I think, but you have to get in front of real users straight away. And then it is a bit different as soon as it comes to writing a book, because you are supposed to consider the audience out there more than yourself. But even so, I found that, you know, writing books, it's still useful to think about that idea of, well, it's someone out there just like me, but they haven't heard this yet. Rather than trying to please everyone, right? Rather than trying to write to a broad range of an audience, to try and imagine this one person reading the book. And that helps me sort of frame how much I write when in terms of, you know, how much background detail do I need to go into here? How much knowledge do I assume that the reader has about this topic? And so if I have this idea in my head, well, they're just like me, they just haven't heard about this thing yet, that's a useful way of framing it. And actually, I came across a really great piece of advice on the website of CodeBar, which is a group that they teach code to underrepresented people in technology, in sort of evening classes, and I help out sometimes. And they've got a page of guidance for coaches and teachers. And one of the things there says that assume that the learner has zero knowledge but infinite intelligence. And I really like that, because that's how you kind of solve that dilemma between being, I don't want to be condescending here, you know, and explaining everything too much, but at the same time you don't want to be arrogant and be like, well, obviously this is obvious and everyone knows this, when maybe the person reading doesn't know that. So I try to keep that mantra in my head, that the reader has zero knowledge but infinite intelligence. But writing books does feel a bit different to just writing a blog post, you know, because you have deadlines and you've got an editor, and it's a bit more serious. And also, once it's published, it's not like the web. You can't really go back and change something, and you can't fix that typo or that punctuation error. So it's a bit scarier for sure.
Where did it even, you know, come about to take on something like writing a book? I feel like writing a book is something that most people at some point in their lives probably think, oh, you know what, I should write a book. Well, maybe they don't, but I think I'm probably confident enough to think that, you know what, I should write a book one day. I don't know what it'd be about yet, but I'll give it a go at some point.
Yeah, I think everyone has that motivation, and it's kind of like so that your mother can have a copy of the book with your name on it, right? That's certainly the motivation for writing your first book, is that so, you know, your family can have it and your name is on the book cover. You certainly don't do it for the money, I'll tell you that, especially not with technology books. But in the case of my first book, it was back in 2005 that it was published. It came out of the sharing again. There was like a local community event where people would share what they knew. It was called Skill Swap, and I gave a talk with my friend Richard on JavaScript stuff. And my other friend Andy, who was there, he's like, you should write this stuff down. Write a book. And he was kind of, needling me. Write a book. I said, all right, fine, I'll give it a shot. And yeah, kind of proposed it to a publisher, and they said, yep, that sounds interesting. And then started doing it. And that first one is particularly paralyzing, and it'll always be way more work than you think it'll be, and you don't know the process, you don't know how the dynamic works between you and the publisher and all these other people involved, the technical editor, the editor. It's a daunting process at first, and it's quite painful. I don't talk to anyone, their first book is never smooth sailing, and most people after they've written a book will say never again. Right, they're glad they've done it. Now their mother has the copy of the book, and that's all great, but never again. And then, a few months, maybe a year later, like, maybe this topic is something I should write another book on, and the cycle repeats all over again.
Well, it's interesting that you wanted to go down that kind of format route, because I think that the podcast and the blogging road is a little bit more liberating in that you kind of control the editorial and the content, and I really like that, and you can kind of go in a little bit more of a random direction, certainly with the pieces like this. I think that's kind of the fun part of them. It's very much the sort of fly on the wall content.
Yeah, and actually my most recent book, I did just put it out there on the web. I mean, you could say self-published, but it was just making a website live. And it was for that reason. Like, I didn't want it to be meddled with, I guess. That's a very negative way to put it, even though the meddling is often very, very positive for the book. But I just wanted, it was sort of quite personal, and I wanted it to be my work. And that meant I'd have to forego all the advantages you get from collaborating with the people at the publishers and obviously distribution and having a physical book. But if I'm willing to forego that and just put it up there on the web, then I can sort of point it and say, I made that and it's entirely me. And any mistakes in it are entirely mine, but also anything you like in it, that's entirely me too. So, depending on what you're looking to get out of it, you can either work with a publisher, work entirely on your own, find some compromise halfway between the two. There's many different ways to put things out there these days.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I think it's all about your motivations at the time as well. I think, I'm particularly enjoying the podcast for a lot of reasons, but, one of them is just actually the collaborations and, getting the opportunity to connect with some, incredibly talented people and just a learning experience. I've kind of built it so it's kind of an extended, place for me to actually learn things. And I think maybe you get to the book part when you feel as though you've got something to tell. But I think that's just an example of, how great it is in today's age to be able to connect with people like yourself and actually just, just learn, have a conversation. It's a networking thing. It's an experience thing. It's a way to, poke your head outside the bubble that you kind of live in.
Oh, yeah, completely. I mean, At Clear Left, we put on events all the time, and it's totally selfish. It's because we want to hear from these people, and we want to talk to these people, and we want to, get them over here and talk to us. So, yeah, it's like connecting with people, is somewhat selfish, and yet it's also this great way of creating community.
It's it's no secret that you've obviously had success, and I just think it's fantastic to ever meet someone who's so compelled to, really put stuff out there. But, what was it like in the kind of the early days of the actual, the actual business? Was that kind of a similar project and a similar process to, the content creation? And the reason why I kind of asked that is because it's all about kind of getting into good habits. If you start off by, making yourself post consistently on a blog, or have a consistent release date for a podcast, I feel as though that sets you up well as far as getting into good habits, and it's relatively a transferable skill that you can take into commerce. I just wonder, about your kind of experiences when you were starting the business, and whether you do think that putting this content out there is a good kind of training ground for, you know, taking it to the next level and actually building a business.
Well, I totally agree with you about the habits. I mean, you talk to any professional writer and they say, look, there's no shortcuts. You've got to, you know, set your alarm clock and you get up a certain time and you got your writing time. You got a number of words you got to hit that day. And there's no shortcuts. There's no waiting for muse to inspire you, right? It's like you just got to put in the work. And I think at work as well, over the years, I've started to realize, yeah, the power of ritual, right? When you identify something that works, to try and ritualize it, even the stuff that's so embedded, it goes without saying, sometimes it's really good to still say it, right? To ritualize and say, this is what we believe, this is what we think works, to have that said out loud. So yeah, the power of habit and ritual, I think, is really powerful. Yeah. But at the same time, I feel like if you're constantly looking for like the perfect process, right, for your business, the perfect way of working, it's kind of like that same negative outlook you could have, like, oh, it's never perfect. It's never perfect. But once you accept that it's never perfect, you can change that and realizing it's an ever evolving, changing process. And I would say that's still true. So the agency Clear Left has been around for 12 years now. And certainly at the beginning, we had no real clue what we were doing, right? With three people starting an agency, we've never run a business before. So we're figuring out as we go along. Here we are 12 years later and we've got things in place. We've got processes. We've learned from 12 years of experience. That's great. But there's still stuff we're figuring out, right? There's lots of stuff, I would say. We're still, you know, not satisfied with the way some things work. And we've identified stuff that does work and we try to make that repeatable, right, to learn from it. But it's a constant process of figuring out what works. And also what works when you're three people or five people or seven people is not necessarily going to work once you hit, you know, 12 or 15 or 20. So there's that as well, that sometimes all of this or a whole bunch of knowledge or ways of working you've accumulated that have been really valuable, maybe you're going to have to ditch that because they no longer apply, because either, you know, the market has changed, your business itself has changed, the people have changed. You have to be willing to be flexible with processes and ways of working and be willing to adapt while still trying to find those repeatable things that work. But in terms of, you know, when we started, like I said, we really didn't have much of a clue what we were doing. And then that was tricky. But I would say what worked was that we had a good mix of people who were willing to try different things. So, for example, I'd been freelancing before this, you know, freelance web designer. You kind of had to do everything, like, you know, bit of front end, bit of back end, bit of design. But, you know, I have to find the business. You have to chase up the invoices. Right? You're doing all this stuff yourself. And once you got more people together, you get that kind of the economies of scale where you can have somebody specialize in one of those things. And if that's what they want to do, that's great. They can spend their days doing that. Whereas, you know, me, I never enjoyed the chasing the business or chasing up invoices. And from the day one of Clear Left, I never had to worry about that anymore because now that's somebody else's job, right? Somebody else can take care of that and leave me to concentrate on the bit I enjoy, which will probably also be the bit that I'm going to be best at. So that's something that's good that comes with as the business grows. You get the economy of scale that you know, you get that you can specialize in the things you want to be doing instead of feeling like I have to do that. But then as the business grows again, you know, stuff happens where you're like, oh, I guess I need to make this part of my job now. And it's something you've never had to do before. But now that you're leading a team of people, you're going to have to get used to it. Right. And that's scary and challenging. So there's always new challenges, but there's always learnings from before as well. And it's finding that mishmash, right? How to put those two things together.
Yeah, it's all about, I suppose, I'm coming at it from kind of the entrepreneurial perspective, but I think that the systems, the habits, you know, everything that I think we've kind of covered, it's all about approach to things. I've talked to several people on the podcast who, you know, are, you know, now senior directors at, you know, large technology companies and, you know, things of that kind of nature. And I think you learn skills, you pick up skills. But one thing that they kind of hold true is about the approach. And that's inevitably what allows people to be productive and, you know, have successes, is finding that kind of approach that works for you. And I think the difficult thing is you can listen to all the blogs and all the podcasts in the world, but inevitably, you know, yeah, use them as a guide, but it's an individual thing, which is why it's so difficult, because there is so many variables involved in the way that people work and what works for them. And you just have to find yours, whatever that is that works, and run with it, and you will get to whatever the outcomes that you desire are.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I guess what you're talking about there is the meta skills, right? So it's not particular technical skills or design skills, but the frameworks for learning skills, or the frameworks for putting things into practice. And it's, you know, the horrible phrase soft skills, but obviously the so-called soft skills are by far the most useful, you know, practical human skills you can have that unlock all the other things you can do. It's because of the soft skills that you get work done. This has been on my mind a lot lately. I've been sort of examining myself about this. Like, what's the right thing to do? Is it that you find that stuff you enjoy and you're good at, and you amplify that, right? So that's you get better at it. Or is it you identify the bits of your job you're not good at and you don't really enjoy, and you try and get better at them? And I'm not yet sure which way to go. You know, you go too far in one direction and you're in a you get too specialized and you can only do this one thing really well. You go too far in the other and you spend all your time doing stuff that you don't enjoy, and you're gonna burn out. So it's a constant learning process, and it's been in my mind a lot lately because we've actually just run a whole event sort of on this topic. So to back up a bit, one of the events we've been running for years, next year it'll be the 10th year, is a conference called UX London. So as I was saying, the reason we do it is because we want to hear from all these, you know, leading designers and thinkers, and get them over to the UK and talk. And we turn it into a conference so other people can listen too. But to be honest, the reason why we put the lineup together is because we want to hear these people. And something we noticed at recent UX London's last couple of years, we're talking to all these people who had been designers, you know, practitioners doing the work. And now they've been promoted, and they've been promoted into management. They're not so much doing the work anymore. They're sort of managing teams, and they didn't know what to do. They're like, I've been promoted into this director position. I have no idea what I'm doing. Help. And so we spun up a new event. I say we, it's my colleague Andy who noticed this and ran the event. We started a new event called Leading Design, and we just had the Leading Design last week in London. It was at the Barbican. And I was there, and I felt like I was being a fly on the wall, because at ClearLeft, I'm not leading up a design team. I'm head of the sort of technology side of things, the web development, right? So front-end developers. And so I thought, well, I'm kind of gate-crashing this, because this is about design, right? It's called Leading Design. But it was really fascinating, because in the 2 days of talks at Leading Design, there was far more emphasis on the leading part than on the design part. There were a few bits that were specific to designers, but honestly, it was more about, okay, your role has changed. You used to make things, do things. Now you're, you know, managing in charge of a group of people, and they're doing the making and they're doing the doing. How does that feel? How do you get used to that? Do you get used to that? Maybe there's another route. Maybe you don't have to do management as the only way of progressing into a large organization. So it was really fascinating for me, because it really helped crystallize, I guess, what my work is now more than what my work used to be. My work used to be I would actually make web pages and I would write code. And now my work is more about the meta skills you were talking about, making sure the systems are in place for the people who are making the websites and writing the code, making sure they're happy, making sure they got what they need, making sure they're motivated, you know, that they're being pushed but not pushed too much, that they're learning as they are, not stagnating. And it was really fascinating for me to think about that and clarify what I should be doing, I guess, what I feel my job should be. But still also wanting to have that feeling of not losing touch, right? This is the thing I think that a lot of designers and developers worry about when they do end up doing more of the management and leading side of things, is that their skills will atrophy, that they won't be at the coalface making things. And so they become irrelevant to a certain extent. And that's a legitimate fear to have. That's something I try to balance by having, you know, personal projects or just constantly sticking my nose into interesting things and learning about them and trying them out. Trying to get that balance between keeping up to date and keeping the skills fresh and yet realizing that that's your job now is not measured in lines of code or numbers of pixels, and that the skills you need aren't, you know, a programming language or design tool. The skills you need are those meta skills and those so-called soft skills, and that those are actually the really valuable things.
Yeah, and it kind of brings us full circle, because in order to stay on top of everything, you have to be, as you said, sticking your nose in things and you know, keeping your eye on, you know, what's going on in the marketplace, you know, advice, and you can get all this from this kind of sharing economy.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that kind of brings us full circle into saying that, you know, we're learning and, you know, we're giving back, and there's that sense that we're all, you know, feel vulnerable at some times in our career, in that we're concerned, and especially, you know, technical people, because it's the rate of change that, you know, things
absolutely
are happening.
Something I've noticed is that, you know, I'll
feel guilty because maybe I'm spending my time doing what you're talking about. Like I'm reading something, I'm researching, I'm like, oh, that's interesting. There's a shiny thing. I want to hear more about that. And I think, oh, I should really be doing something more directly work related right now, right? I'm sitting in the office reading something somebody's published or looking at some code somebody's put out. And I think, oh, am I slacking off? Is this like not the work? And then I'll share that thing. I'll put it on my website. And like I say, it's kind of half for myself, because I'm thinking I'll tag it for later. You know, this is for me to remember later. And then at work, maybe a week later, maybe a month later, we'll be in a meeting, we'll be discussing something, and something will come up and I'll go, oh, wait, you know what? That reminds me of something I was reading about. Or that reminds me of something I was investigating. And I'll pull it up on my website, and it will turn out to have a directly beneficial effect for the people who are, you know, working on the project under discussion. Like, oh, that's interesting. And we never would have come across this if I hadn't been, you know, slacking off and doing that other side of the work, I guess, which is just keeping up to date and keeping your hand in, yeah, sticking your nose into that stuff. So, yeah, you're right. There's kind of a virtuous circle that seems to happen, you know, then they're like, put stuff out there, share, and it benefits you in the long run, and you're benefiting other people in the short term. And, you know, maybe there's some sort of karmic wheel of justice, and what goes around comes around, and the more you share, the better it'll be for everyone.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, we can attribute a lot of that as to the reason why we're progressing so quickly in the technology space, and things are happening so fast because of this sharing economy. I would be surprised if a lot of people wouldn't agree that, you know, that is a big part of it. You know, there's a lot more transparency, and with that transparency, I think it bleeds kind of innovation and creativity.
Yeah, well, it surprised me sometimes, because I agree with you completely. I think the barrier now to launching a business or a product or just a project, like a crazy little art thing, is really low on the web. And, you know, what in the past you would have had to get, you know, expensive servers and write your own software to do lots of stuff. Now you can spin up, you know, very cheaply these, you know, cloud computing things, and you can have an idea and get it out there really quick. And yet I don't see that happening so much. I still see people kind of chasing the big company. Like the metrics for success have somewhat shifted over the years in the opposite direction. What I mean is, like, I remember, you know, maybe 10, 12 years ago, you could have a little business that just did one thing and did it well, and that would be considered a success, right? You've got a photo sharing site, all it does is share photos, that's fine. You've got an event site, all it does is allow people to attend events, that's all it does. And it'd be, you know, trundle along quite nicely, and people think, oh yeah, nice website, nice service, your business is making a little profit, nice. And then the big success stories came along, you know, like the Facebooks and people like that, and I feel like it changed the metric for success, in that now people think, oh well, you've just got a little business trundling along, that's a failure, because you haven't, you know, sold it to Google or turned it into the next Facebook, you haven't, you know, conquered the planet with it, then it counts as a failure these days. And I think that's such a shame, because that's so at odds with the low barrier to entry to trying something, right? Putting something out there on the web, see how it goes. And obviously the vast majority are never going to be the big successes, right? The Facebooks are clearly the exceptions to the rule. And yet I think it's terrible if you're to judge those small businesses, small projects, the small little experiments to be failures just because they aren't as big as failure as Facebook. When actually I think that's the web is made up of millions of little successes like that, and success defined by different metrics than, you know, IPO or profit, but things like, you know, this improved somebody's life or this made somebody smile, right? I think it's such a shame that our tools have become more accessible, I feel, at a certain level than before, and yet the metrics for what we consider a success seem to have raised so high as to be completely unattainable.
Interesting. It's really interesting, Jeremy. All I can say is we're going to continue to put stuff out there and do our bit in this sharing economy. So hopefully that good karma keeps coming. But we'll leave that for the time being, mate. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for listening to Venturi's Voice. Please make sure you subscribe at iTunes or SoundCloud. Or check out the website, venturi-group.com. And keep up to date with the latest IT jobs, talent, news, and podcasts. Or drop me a line. It's andy.davis@venturi-group.com. Any feedback, topics, or guest suggestions are always welcome. And thanks again for listening to the show. See you next time.